You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, welcome to the show. It's Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I'm Wes Goldberg here, as always, with David Ramil, and tonight we are recapping the Miami Heat's 95-89 win over the Indiana Pacers, the Heat improving to 9-17, and we've won two straight. This is amazing.
Not really. I mean, it's good. it's better than losing three straight or five straight or however many we lost at that point.
But yeah, I mean, one straight.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you're good with numbers, let me tell you. It was an ugly game against a team that's really fallen apart. They started off really well and people were considering them as a legitimate contender, but they've tapered off quite a bit. They're going through some major changes, not just in the roster, but also at the head coaching position. And so I don't know that necessarily winning against this Pacers team isn't the same kind of thing as winning against them back in 2012 or 13 when they were a legitimate challenger to Miami's contention.
Yeah, but so we were like legitimate contenders. Like now we kind of suck. So beating a 500
team. Any win's a good win.
Yeah, beating a playoff team, a team that is poised to make the playoffs in the Eastern Conference, or looks like they might. That's a good win, you know, for Miami. Like, they played up to their competition this game.
You convinced me.
Okay, good. So, that wasn't hard. You know, for every time... So, when we're doing these recaps, I always try to find, like, okay, what was the difference in the game? Was there a number? Was there a player? Was there one? What was the one factor that was the difference in this game? And tonight's game was so closely played. I mean, there wasn't really any long runs, necessarily. There weren't... Right. You know, any major, you know, advantages any one way or the other for the first three quarters, really. I mean, it was a tightly played game for most of the game. And the difference really was that Miami was able to hold the Pacers to just 10 points in the fourth quarter. Now, on the same side of that, Miami scored just 17 points in the fourth quarter. But they also just held Indiana to four. And I don't think that was just a matter of the Pacers missing shots. I thought Miami played really great defense. And I thought they really liked having Justice Winslow back, who was finally back after spraining his wrist. He missed 16 straight games. This was his first game back. He had a huge impact on the defensive end, don't you think?
Yeah, I'd say so. He was pretty solid overall. I think, having his body, his versatility there, the fact that he could slide onto a number of different positions to defensively, I think really was a big plus there. I don't know that statistically he stood out on the defensive end, but for the most part, I think he just good body defense, I think, and really harassed the Pacers team that, to me, looks, again, discombobulated all night. I mean, it was tough for me watching this game because, to be honest with you, I was thinking, part of it was obviously that Miami played some pretty solid defense overall, but you have to be honest here. I think Indiana also played pretty poorly, just shooting 37.1% yes. overall, 33.3% from three-point range. They were missing a lot of open shots, with the exception, I think, of Paul George, who heated up in the third quarter, and C.J. Miles, who finished with 15 points on 3 or 6 3-point shooting. I think nobody else on that team really looks determined or able to score at will. Even Miles Turner, who's quietly having a pretty good season, finished with only 11 points on 5 or 13 shooting, and he missed all of his 3 3-point attempts. So, I mean, they were struggling offensively. And part of that, sure, was Miami's defense, but there was also some issues there where they were just missing wide open shots.
There was one play that I did want to point out with Justice Winslow, and this was one where not something that the Heat has seen when Winslow is out. Miles Turner had him on a mismatch in the post, and you could tell that the Pacers recognized it immediately, and Winslow knew that they were going to come to him, and he positioned himself right on the hip of Miles Turner, and as soon as that bounce pass came into him, he jumped the route, so to speak, and intercepted it and took it down and was able to get it to Tyler Johnson in transition for a fast break layup. And it was a huge swing there for Miami because I have it written down here. At that point, before that, it was a 1-point game. It was 80-79. There was about 9 minutes and 39 seconds left when Winslow did that. He knocks the ball away, gets it to Tyler Johnson, and it's an 82-79 game. Doesn't seem like a lot. It's just a 3-point lead. But if you're Miles Turner and you have a huge height advantage, that's a big mismatch against Winslow, and Winslow's rusty, you really could see Miles Turner scoring there. That's he very well could have just scored there, and all of a sudden Indiana has a lead. So that's a 5-point swing in a lot of ways, or a 4-point swing in a lot of ways. Miami was able to kind of take that and build a 5-point lead, and that was really that 5-point, 6-point buffer that they had going the rest of the game.
It was a big play. I think the lack of offense on from either team kind of had that AAA crowd in a little bit of a mild doldrum all day. You know, I think they were watching the game and looking for a big shot or a big athletic play, and really they weren't getting it from anybody, either in Miami's side or from the Pacers. And then on that one particular play, what stood out about that was not just that he was able to come around a much bigger player in Turner, but he corralled the ball as it was sailing out of bounds, flipped it behind his back towards the streaking Johnson, who caught up and then was able to finish the layup. And that was a big play. Again, it really built momentum from that point forward. And for the first time, I think for most of the night, you really heard that crowd finally start to perk up and they really started cheering for a team. I mean, it's difficult, for Miami fans, as beleaguered as they've been, there's obviously a great sense of loyalty there. But even particularly in a year like this, where the team has struggled as much as they have, particularly at home, it's difficult to root for a team that struggles in so many different areas. So I understand why there was a lack of enthusiasm there. But seeing a big play, particularly from a guy that you like in Justice Winslow, I think it's always an exciting thing. And to welcome him back after a 16-game loss, I mean, that's huge. So I think that was a really nice play. And again, it did turn the tide in Miami's favor.
So other than the defense in the fourth quarter, I thought one of the other differences in the game was that the Heat, while both offenses have clearly struggled in this game, Miami at least had an identity. They had a game plan where it was they pressured the rim against Indiana with the pick and roll almost every play, it seemed like. It was always something with a pick and roll, with Whiteside diving to the rim, with either Goran Dragic or Tyler Johnson handling it. Tyler Johnson, by the way, did a very good job, I thought, in the pick and roll, leading the pick and roll, especially in the second half of this game. So they kind of just went to that. They were going to live and they were going to die by that. Indiana, at the same time, I don't know. I didn't really know what their plan was for attacking Miami's defense. Their whole plan this whole season has really been drive and kick stuff, trying to get three-pointers. We know Miami is good at running guys, opponents off the three-point line and limiting three-pointers. I think them and Utah allow the fewest three-point attempts a game in the league this season. Paul George, he had 22 points, but it was on 22 shots, so not efficient at all.
Right.
And I thought that Indiana, that's what really, I think, started coming up in the fourth quarter, was that Miami was able to just outscore them in that fourth period because they at least knew what they were going to try to do, while Indiana, everything they tried, if they tried anything really consistently, failed, basically.
Yeah, and shouts out to Rodney McGruder, who had, I think he bore the brunt of trying to guard George all night. It was, as cliche as it might sound, though, a defensive effort by committee, in that several players tried to limit George throughout the night. I saw Tyler doing it. I saw Justice doing it. It was a consistent effort. Josh Richardson at moments. So, I mean, there was a lot of different players, and maybe that was part of the reason why it was so effective, is that everybody was fresh. They were able to hinder him, and he did not look as aggressive as we've seen. There was a moment there in the third quarter where you thought, uh-oh, this is it. This is the PG-13 we've seen for seasons now, and that luckily for Miami, that was not the case. But then, to your point, I did also see maybe I'm wrong here, but I thought I saw Whiteside doing a lot more rim running in tonight's game that we've seen in previous occasions. And in one particular play where Justice Winslow, I think his first offensive set, connected on him on a pick and roll situation where he tossed a lob towards Whiteside. I saw that from a number of different players there. It looked like that was something that they were actively trying to attack. And I know that, obviously Indiana's a little undersized. Turner is a center, but not really. I think he's a little smallish for that position at this point. He's not really much of a big body and certainly not capable of limiting Whiteside defensively. They did have Al Jefferson there, but of course, at this point in his career, he's not really much of a defensive stopper, not that he ever was. So it seemed like they were trying to be particularly aggressive at Whiteside, and it really paid off for him. He looked, he had a really good night. And I saw something from the Sun Sentinel's Ira Winderman about this possibly being Whiteside's open invitation to the national television audience about his All-Star campaign. And we talked about this several weeks ago that, you know, lack of exposure was going to hurt that campaign. But he certainly came up big on a night when he was on ESPN and obviously reaching a far wider audience than he might on a normal game night. So he finished with a 26-point night, 22 rebounds and two blocks, 10 of 16 shooting. It was just a really good night from him overall. It seemed like, at least from the broadcasters, they were really focused on what Whiteside was doing. They talked about, you know, Dragic quite a bit, but a lot of their compliments were directed towards Whiteside. So if he's going to direct any kind of buzz leading up to the All-Star game, this is certainly a good opportunity. He seemed like he made the most of it.
Yeah, I want to keep talking about Whiteside, but really quick, if you love the NBA and you love betting on the NBA, you should check out BetDSI.com. That's BetDSI.com. They've been a top-rated sportsbook for over 20 years. They're safe. They have great customer service. And you know what else? They're easy to use, and they have a great basketball special. Sign up today and get $10 for free to try their service. BetDSI is also offering a 100% bonus on your first deposit. They feature fast and easy payment of winnings. They have hundreds of football, basketball, UFC, golf, whatever you want, wagers to choose from. BetDSI even has live in-game wagering on all football, basketball, and other more major sporting events. So if you forgot to place your bet that morning, you could just bet on the halftime line or something like that. You play virtually everything at BetDSI. So go to BetDSI.com now and use the promotion code HEAT10. That's H-E-A-T-1-0, HEAT10. Get your free wager. Start winning right away with house money. Can't beat that. There's no risk. Use their money and take their money. Sounds great. Okay, so yeah, Whiteside, I thought, you know, he does... All right, just like openly admitting how I watch the Heat, I'm very critical about Hassan Whiteside, basically in every single step, motion, movement he does. Mm-hmm. And I had tweeted a couple times during the game that I was really upset with his screen setting. And this game in particular, yes, did he have 26 points, 22 rebounds? Of course, he had a great game. The Heat don't win this game without Hassan Whiteside and what he did tonight. But, you know, I thought that Goran Dragic really struggled getting going. 4 of 15 from the field, just 11 points. And I thought part of that was because he just didn't have that much space under the rim. And if Whiteside had set better screens for Dragic in those pick-and-roll situations, Dragic probably has more space. If Whiteside sets better screens, he could have finished with 36 points and not 26 points. I really thought the screen setting was weak. I thought it wasn't a situation where he was just trying to slip the screen and get over and try to beat a more agile Miles Turner. I didn't think it was that deliberate. I thought it was more he just doesn't want to screen hard and he wants to get to the rim right now. And that was it. And I wanted to say all that because that was really what I was tweeting for, I think, the first half. In the second half, I thought he really started to put it together. I don't know if it was something Spoelstra said at halftime or what, but even, and then especially in the fourth quarter, those screens got a lot harder. There was more effort put into them, and I was a lot more impressed with Whiteside as that game went on with the screen setting. Somebody must have said something to him because it got better as the game went on, and that was impressive to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to know that, you know, we haven't seen him always be able to make those kinds of adjustments in mid-game. And if that was the case, whether it was something he noticed or something a coach pointed out to him, either way, that's a positive sign. And I think, you know, maybe your more peripheral fan might hear screen setting and go, well, he still finished with 26 points. He still had 22 rebounds. And yes, those numbers, as gaudy as they are, sound really nice. But screen setting, particularly in today's offensive sets and in the NBA, is such a crucial aspect. And there are so many things about setting a screen. There was a great piece, I think, that came out in the Bleacher Report, I want to say either last week or the week before. And I know some of our listeners don't really care about teams other than Miami, but Charlotte's Cody Zeller, there was a great breakdown on how he learned how to set screens for a guy like Kemba Walker, who needs those screens because he's a somewhat undersized. He's not necessarily the most athletic point guard, even though he's very quick, but he can use that quickness a lot more effectively if there's a good screen for it. And they talked about how in the piece, how he learned how to angle his body in just such a way so that Kemba could go around the screen more effectively. He could decide at the very last minute you know, very last split second, really, which direction to go into, and that would often freeze a defender there where they would have to either decide to go over the screen, and then by that point Walker would use his speed to blow past it. And you see that with a guy like Dragic, who, you know, he has that kind of burst, he has that kind of speed, maybe not at the same level as Kemba Walker, but he needs a good screen, and he's certainly much more effective if there is one there for him. And that's just something that Whiteside either hasn't really cared too much about for the most part, or just hasn't learned. And, you know, you know that at this point, he's only been in the league really 2.5 seasons. There's still a chance for him to develop that aspect. But, you know, considering the amount of money he's paying and the fact that he is the main focus of this team, both offensively and defensively, it's something he has to learn and adjust to. So there were some positive signs in the second half, as you pointed out, but it's still a crucial part for him to develop. And I think it's something that we can focus more on as the season progresses.
Yeah, Dragic going 4-15. I mean, so many of those shots were contested layups and at the rim.
Yeah. Right.
And, I mean, he missed 2 3-pointers, but I think he didn't take a lot more perimeter shots than those 2 3-pointers. Mostly everything was mid-range or near the rim. And if Whiteside's setting better screens, that could have easily been 8-15. You know, if he just had a little bit more space to get those shots off and they're not as contested, and all of a sudden Dragic has 20 points in the game. And maybe Whiteside doesn't see anything on his own box score, you know? But if he's going to be a player that the Heat want to build around, he's got to do it from, you know, the first quarter to the fourth quarter and setting those hard, nice screens. And a player he's compared with often is Rudy Gobert. They're compared often defensively. But Rudy Gobert has really learned how to step up his screen game this season. Again, maybe a player that Heat fans aren't really caring about and don't watch a lot of. But he's setting really great screens, and it's taken him to the next level in Utah for them and what they want to do offensively. So that's still something that we want to see. Like I said, in the fourth quarter, I really thought Whiteside stepped it up there. And James Johnson in the winner's circle afterward, he was talking with Jax on Fox Sports Sun, and they kind of asked him about Whiteside, like, hey, you know, 26 points, 22 rebounds, that really gave you a lifting off point to win this game. And James Johnson said, yeah, and there's, you know, James Johnson said something to the effect, like, a few games ago, Whiteside decided he didn't want to be the same old Whiteside anymore, and I think that's really turned his season around. And I don't know what that means, but it means something, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I don't think any player, particularly one that we've seen is as emotional or sensitive as Whiteside, wants to be called out. He's always been very acutely aware of when he starts, when he's benched, what happens. And, you know, this is a guy who's built his reputation over the last season and a half, really. You know, he was a marginal player that nobody really cared about. Everybody knows his story. And so for him, he's always had to work towards something. He had to fight against the reputation that may or may not have been earned by him. And so for him, it's always been, you know, he's always been very aware of how people perceive them and how he's put in certain situations from his coaching staff. And, you know, we've seen that that he's been disgruntled about his role. And it's something that, you know, Spoelstra's always had to handle with kid gloves. And this season, you know, as much as Whiteside is the focus of this team, there was that moment a few games ago against the Cleveland Cavaliers, if I'm not mistaken, where he just was not playing particularly well. And Spoelstra did the right thing, I think. You know, you have to give – it's a delicate balance there, a tightrope that Spoelstra has to walk, especially with a player like Whiteside. You know, but you have to figure out the best way of maximizing what he can do on the floor. And if he's not being productive, is he's not giving maximum effort – you don't want to call him out necessarily. You're not going to gain any benefit from yelling at him behind closed doors or in the middle of a game. So you bench him and you let him know, look, we're not going to tolerate this kind of behavior. And you can't say that publicly, as Spoelstra never did when he was interviewed after the game. But, you know, he did allude to the fact that Whiteside wasn't necessarily giving 100% and things of that sort. And if that's enough of a spark to turn him around, well, I'm all for it, to be honest with you.
Whiteside and Wayne Ellington were the only starters with positive plus-minuses in the game. They were plus one. But the bench did the heavy lifting, and I do want to talk about one of those guys in particular, and that's James Johnson. James Johnson was a plus-16 off the bench. That was a Miami Heat game high. It was a game high. You know, nobody on the Pacers beat that. 25 minutes, had 14 points, 6 assists, 3 rebounds. Was 6-9 from the field, hit his only 3-pointer he took. I mean, that James Johnson continues to be the most consistent and most versatile player on the court for the Heat. He had a great game.
I mean, I think it starts – look, he hasn't had huge games. And, you know, I'm trying to think amongst other top six man in the year candidates.
That's like kind of what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. Ennis Kanter, Wilson Chandler. I know I'm missing a couple names here and there.
Is Lou Williams starting for the Lakers? He's having a good year.
Williams, yeah. I mean, the Lakers are always going to generate a lot of attention. I mean, obviously, guys like Jamal Crawford and Andre Iguodala playing for the teams that they are always going to have some consideration. But I think Kanter, Chandler, I'm drawing a blank here. I know that there are others that probably deserve some consideration or have been discussed as legitimate six-man candidates. But, I mean, look, Miami's
Patrick
not –
Beverly. Is he starting or is Eric Gordon starting now? I don't know. One of the, either Eric Gordon or Patrick Beverly in Houston, probably one of them.
Gordon isn't starting, I think. He's coming off the bench. I just saw a piece earlier on how he's thrived lately coming off the bench.
So, yeah, and maybe him. But, either way, I see your point. James Johnson is starting to make a case that he should get some consideration for Sixth Man of the Year.
Probably – most improved player is probably something that he'll garner some consideration for, and deservedly so. Although those kinds of awards are generally left for like players that whether, you know, they were particularly bad last year and now all of a sudden they've achieved superstar status or close to, or guys that might have been injured last year and all of a sudden.
I hate how we award most improved, because basically you can have a shit season and then come back the next year and have a fine season and you win an award for it just because you had a shit season last year.
Right.
It's like James Johnson, if you look at his story. Maybe we should get this going. James Johnson, if you look at his story about, like, you know, he's been a journeyman throughout his career. He's always been told, like, he needs to lose weight, but he always just tried to, you know, go Atkins diet or something and just drop weight really quickly or whatever. And he's talked about this a few times already this year about how he lost weight the right way, how he really just got more dedicated in the gym and really tried to not only maintain and increase his strength but also lose weight at the same time, where a lot of times you can't do both, you know?
Right.
And he really focused on doing both. He changed everything about his, you know, regimen to do that. And that, to me, is how you get improved. Like, that is most improved, that you dedicated to improving. You didn't just have a shitty year and then had a not-so-bad year the next time.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's – most awards, I think, in general, are awarded for very – you know, different and varying criteria. So there's never going to be a perfect way of awarding. You can't measure it. I mean, there are players on bad teams that probably have deserved most valuable player consideration in the past and certainly haven't done so just because their team is in the playoffs. And then you look at, you know, a guy like Steph Curry or even this year, Kevin Durant. They're playing great basketball, to be sure. But part of that, what makes it easier for them, is the fact that they're playing with other great players. And
thought last year the NBA got it right with CJ McCollum. I thought that was a good one. He took a leap, you know, and that was good. But I don't want to talk too much about most improved. I do want to talk a little bit more about James Johnson because of that versatility that he brings.
Yeah.
We were talking about the Heat using him at center and how that was a new thing. That's really been the hot story of the week for the Heat.
Yeah.
And you know, you want to start keeping track of, okay, how often and when are they going to go to that James Johnson center lineup? Is it going to be a situation where maybe Whiteside's not playing so well and you just put James Johnson in at center? Or is it going to be a regular thing? Is James Johnson going to play center for the last 2 minutes of every half or something like that, or whatever it might be? And so I kept track of it. He played center for the last minute of the first half. And then he was back at center between the 9 minute mark and the roughly the 5 minute mark of the fourth quarter. So 5 minutes in total ish with James Johnson at center, which that sounds about right to me when Willie Reed is playing 7 minutes and then Whiteside's having obviously such an effective game with he played 34 minutes himself. So if Whiteside's having that great of a game and he warrants being on the court for 34 minutes and only picks up 3 fouls in the game, so never really in foul trouble, 5 minutes a game sounds about right for James Johnson. And I would even venture to say Whiteside's not going to score 26 points and 22 rebounds a game. We might see that creep up to maybe 7 or 8 minutes a game.
That's fair. I could see why. I mean, it looks effective at this point, and I think, and you know, it's obviously helped out by the fact that Johnson is a willing defender, even on players much bigger than him. And it's usually at this point in a game when there's either a second string center or a smaller lineup in there, and that's why Spoelstra could use it. And at the same time, conversely, I think if Spoelstra goes to it, then he sets the tone. He says, look, this is the lineup we're going to go to, and he forces his players to adjust defensively, but he's also forcing the other team to make the same adjustment. So that's an interesting one.
And I like that Winslow was involved at the four while James Johnson was at center. That was really great. Winslow played his first game, as we mentioned, but he didn't come in until like 47 seconds left in the first quarter. That's when he first came in. But he played 21 minutes, and he didn't close the game. Winslow didn't close the game, obviously, coming back from an injury. You don't want him at the end there. Josh Richardson took the responsibility of defending Paul George in the last few minutes of the fourth quarter. So Winslow, his 21 minutes really came in, you know, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the first half of the fourth quarter. So he was in there for a long time in that chunk, in that middle chunk of the game. And I thought he played well enough. 1 of 5 from the field wasn't great. Just 2 points, 2 rebounds, 2 assists, 1 steal, that 1 steal that we had just talked about. But you're not really looking for numbers when it's his first game back and he's as rusty as he is. He was a
plus 8. You want to grade it?
I'd say it was a complete. He was present. That's my grade.
I give it a C+.
I was going to say C if you want to get a letter grade, but yeah, right around there. That's fine, right? Like, he's back.
It's his first game back after a prolonged absence. So yeah, I mean, you understand that there's going to be some rust there, even and for a guy who's always struggled offensively, there's going to be rust, especially. But yeah,
I do. I hope when we get more information on Winslow, this is not a situation where it might be on and off. I hope he's back, like he's actually back, and that would be good. Because he was kind of a last minute kind of inclusion in this game. So. No Derek Williams, no Haslam, no Luke Babbitt, no Deion Waiters in this game. Any other notes that we want to follow up with before we...
No, not particularly.
Yeah.
Josh McRoberts hit a 3-pointer. That was pretty good.
That was pretty good. Also, Indiana's not very good, I don't think. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but like they're 13-13, but that's shaky. That's a shaky 500 record. I don't see how this team does anything.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, and there's been some
this team's discussion. Worse than Monte Ellis plays, too.
That's a good point. They were missing Ellis, but he's not necessarily helping that team. There's been some rumored talk about Paul George being traded. I think I saw that the new collective bargaining agreement allows the Pacers to extend his contract or re-sign him for a significant amount, a larger amount than any other team. So that's something to keep in mind. If he is in fact traded, it would not be in his best interest, so he may not want a trade.
Well, it would, because he wouldn't play for the Pacers anymore. There's just some things money can't buy.
Yeah.
He could pay to leave the Pacers. All right. Well, I think that's all we have, right?
Yeah. Upcoming game, Friday versus the LA Clippers.
That's right. Should be a good one.
Winners tonight against the Orlando Magic, so they're continuing their East Coast swing.
Right. In Miami... This is their third game on their homestand. They'll continue that with the Clippers on Friday night. We're not gonna have a recap for that, but.
But the DeAndre Jordan Hassan Whiteside matchup should be a good one, and that's always a good barometer to see whether or not Whiteside is starting to make some kind of progression there.
Good point. All right, that's all we have for today. Thanks to our sponsor, BetDSI, the leader in providing safe, legal, and secure online betting on all of your favorite sporting events, all of them. Use the promo code HEAT10, that's HEAT10, to play with house money. Get a free $10 bet. I don't see how people don't do that. Just do that. Free money. Whether you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, thank you for listening. Get in touch with the show on Twitter at LockedOnHeat or by email, where you can send us mailbag questions, comments, or sponsorship opportunities. That's LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. And if you're not subscribed already, please do so to get the podcast automatically every day. Then go to iTunes and leave a nice little comment and a review and a rating. It helps other people discover the show. And by all means, tell your friends about the show on Facebook or Twitter or, you know, whatever. All right. That's all we got. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.
Hey, it's Wes again. I wanted to tell you about the Monday Morning Heat Check. Would you enjoy getting a small email, a newsletter from me every Monday morning? where I share the best stories and digital content about the Miami Heat from the week before and for the week ahead. Just a little something to keep you up to speed. There'll be exclusive content from me as well, opinions, analysis, etc., and a few other surprises that I'm still working on along the way. Again, just a little something for you every Monday morning. So if that's something you're interested in, just go to tinyurl.com/Monday Morning Heat Check. That's tinyurl.com/Monday Morning Heat Check and drop in your email. It's that easy.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.